10 times and realize 10 minutes has gone by, and stuff like that. But it's always only about stuff that I can't do anything about. And once I put that out in the light, either to myself or to other people, or gratitude list or whatever, it's much, much clearer. And I can continue what I want, but it's like, what's the point? They came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. As I sort of shared earlier, I could not have accepted that power had to be God in any conventional sense when I came here. And I'm so glad that it wasn't. And I'm so glad, as I shared earlier, that my sponsor just slipped me right over step three in terms of doing battle, because I was geared for it. And one of the things it says in 12 and 12, I think it's at the end of step 6, is that the first step is the only step we have to work perfectly. We have to admit total powerlessness and total unmanageability in order to go forward. But that's it. Everything else, we just wing it. We just do the very best we can do any given day. And somehow that's helped me a lot. It's helped me, first of all, when I try to reclaim a sense of power and manageability. That's certainly been useful, that I just either go all the way or not. And secondly, that wherever I am in any of the other steps, it's just the best I can do that day. And, you know, with step two, what I've come to believe over the years is that, yeah, we have 12 steps, but some of them have higher risers than others. You know, some are low and some are high. And in my experience, the very highest riser is step two. I think that is the most likely place for me, for other people, to get caught. To really believe that there is a power greater than myself or ourselves, that power is really going to do something for me, and that I really am stark, raving, delusional mad in my disease. Those are really tough things, and people don't want to go there. And I understand that. Particularly the thing about that God will actually do something for me. I suppose that's the most common thing I hear. That's a step two thing. And I just have to empathize, because I know that feeling. You know? And at the same time, it's still just a step. And we just do the best we can, and then we go on and do the others. God, as we understood him, as I mentioned earlier, is, for me, took the form of taking on a relationship with God that was not part of my childhood, was not part of my upbringing, not even part of my profession. In fact, talking about God, I remember my mentor, who at that time was in his mid to late 70s, was just a wonderful human being, and I had been sober just about a year, a little less than a year, and I was meeting with him. His name was Harry, and I said, "Harry, you know, I just developed this sense of God that's really powerful, and I have immense respect for him." And he turned to me and he practically begged me to not talk about God in my work. And I thought, this is bizarre. He was right. He often was. It wasn't that there was anything wrong with my belief. He wasn't suggesting that in the least. He was just saying, you know, some people just can't handle it. Not the way you're talking about it. And it really stunned me at the time. And yet I realized that this God as we understood him is everybody's we, you know? And everybody's working on a different way of doing that and has different backgrounds and histories and disappointments and hopes. And they all put them together in a way, and they had different step two experiences of whatever sort. And that phrase has become more important to me, those italics, over time, and of course they're repeated twice in the steps, and I think that's important. The fourth step, I was telling someone earlier, I remember reading a book once, it was not a 12-step book, but it was about 12 steps, and it made a big deal about fearless moral inventory. And at first I resented it, and then I kind of let it soak in for a while, and realized what they were really trying to say is this opportunity to look at ourselves as close to objectively as possible is really a great gift. And to look at the assets and the liabilities, to look at the crap and look at the good stuff. And that's what the fearless part is. And of course, you know, I can get into fear as rapidly as anybody. I would like to say I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, like it says in the big book, and I would have told you that I was, but my sponsor once said, I was whining to him about something, about fear. He said, write down 100 forms of fear. And I couldn't get past like 72 or 78 or somewhere. And it was so humiliating. I couldn't even come up with 100 forms of fear. But the fact is, it's a familiar companion. Because I lose trust. I think God isn't going to be there for me when I need him. And that's not my experience. It's just my head that tells me that. So the fourth step is a chance to do this fearless thing and to do it all of our lives. A lot of people use many different formats. A lot of people, they'll say, well, I used the AA format, I used four columns. And the AA format is three columns, and it's on page 65. And I've become quite attached to it. Not so much because I'm a big book fanatic, but as I said earlier, it turns out to be the most straightforward, efficient, and easy way to do a really successful fourth step. And I've done all sorts of different ways of doing it. So I had sort of stumbled into that, and basically I'll just say the secret, if it's not a secret, but I mean the thing that makes it work is to do it by columns, to list all of the people, situations, institutions, and leave space between them, and just do that. If someone actually does that, which they often don't, but if they do it, it takes about 30 minutes. And then do the middle column, which might well take a month or two, and sometimes less, but frequently that. And then do the third column, which is going to take 15 minutes no matter how you do it. The fourth column that's usually added is, what was my contribution to this situation? How did I set it up? And I think that's an extremely important column, but it's not a fourth step column. It's a fifth step column. And it gets added when the fifth step, it gets done when the fifth step just happens. So when I do four steps and when I have people do them with me, they do the three columns. And yet, as often as I say that, I just had this experience on Thursday. People have trouble understanding. It doesn't make any sense. Someone brought me in her fourth step list, and it was just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 all in line. And so I made her just take the same words, same people, go back and put an inch or 2 or 4 inches or a whole page, and, you know, between them. And boy, she didn't want to do it. And yet, it will make her job so much easier. And actually, we did one sort of experimentally, and I think she began to get the hang of it. I found this works in my experience with four step, because I've done quite a few and I probably need to do another one. Gave me, I must admit, a lot of pleasure is there's a couple of AA guys, Joe and Charlie, who do big book study things all over the United States on cruise ships everywhere. And usually their most recent series is available on tapes and CDs pretty quickly. And that's exactly how they do it. And I thought, oh, good, I'm doing something that's other people think it's a good idea, too. Fifth step, of course, is the biggie. As I said, we get used to that idea that God knows all about us. And there's something about being honest with another person, and if someone does a fifth step with me, it takes them a while to get into the routine because they don't want to do it. But at the end of each, you know, person, what happened, what was the root cause, then what was your contribution to it? And of course, there are patterns. We all have patterns. And one of the most common patterns is, I'm still holding on to that resentment. I am not going to let it go. It's mine. You know. And of course, when you get 4 or 5 times round on this, it begins, oh, I'm really making a choice to hold on to that resentment, aren't I? Or that fear, or that lust image, whatever, sex image. Another real common pattern is wishing the situation had been different. I'm holding on to this fantasy that it could have been different than the way it was. And again, what is my contribution to that is something that I think is exactly what needs to happen in the fifth step. But, so that's the ways four and five come out for me. And my experience is people try to be thorough. I've had people want to do incredibly exhaustive fourth steps. One guy, I think, took a total of 8 hours to listen to. And I've had other people do them, and we get through them in 2 or 3. It's pretty rare to go under 3 hours. But what I found that it's the exhaustive is helpful, as long as it's exhaustive in terms of types of situations. In terms of listing every situation, it doesn't seem to be as critical, because it's not, if the exact nature of our wrongs frequently turns out not to be so much the what I did or didn't do, but why was I doing it again? And what is the pattern? What was the character defect that set me up over and over again? And almost always in the what was my contribution to it, that becomes very clear. And then the person has the choice, do I want to hold on to this character defect or do I want to let God have it? And that puts us on 6 and 7. We're entirely ready and humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Those are just everyday steps. I think there's a reason why they're the shortest steps in the whole big book in terms of paragraphs, and they're pretty much equal sized in 12 and 12. And one of the most useful sentences in the 12 and 12 is the very last page of step 7. And I refer to it frequently, both in my head and also out loud with people. And that's this: what gets us going on our defects, and certainly true for me. The chief activator of our defects has been self-centered fear, primarily fear that we would lose something we already possessed or would fail to get something we demanded. Living on a basis of unsatisfied demands, we were in a state of continual disturbance and frustration. Therefore, no peace was to be had unless we could find a means of reducing these demands. And then here comes the insult. You're not going to add injury to insult here. The difference between a demand and a simple plain request is simple request is plain to anyone. Oh yeah, right. That's why I'm in this program. But in fact, that's the truth. That when I change from a demand to a request, suddenly what the other person, instead of getting my, first of all my fear is getting going, and then secondly the other person's defense is getting going, which is the same thing. It becomes a conversation. And you know, conversations are not threatening. But assault and defense is kind of a no-win situation. 8th and 9th, making a list. My own feeling on step 8 out of doing them and working with other people is that it's just what it says. It's a list of all people we think we've harmed and becoming willing to make amends to them all. I have no problem with people. In fact, I want people to put as many names as possible on your 8-step list, I tell them. And if you do, just a list of names and maybe one or two words about how you've harmed the person, it typically takes about 20 to 30 minutes. There's a rule of 800 that applies here, however, and that is most people, including myself, will try to put off doing the 8-step about 800 times as long as it takes to actually do it. Now, usually we use numbers like 3 and 7, you know, but in this case it's 800. And you'll find it's amazingly accurate if you start keeping track. But I try to convince people, just do it. Do the list. Just get it written down. Then share it. Now, magical things happen in the sharing because the sponsor asks this really awkward question. Well, how did you harm them? And my sponsor, I would say how I thought I harmed this woman I'd acted out with. And he said, you were a true jerk. And you were taking advantage of someone who was willing, but you were taking advantage, and all that kind of stuff. But you know, what harm did you do? You know, and, well, I guess probably no harm. I just was doing that terrible stuff I did when I was drunk. Well, did you harm her? No. That was a tough one because I really assumed that that was the only possible response. But he said, you don't make amends to people you got drunk with, and that's a place where 12-step recovery and therapy really diverge. They come back together, but they diverge there. And all I can say is I found, for me, it's been the more helpful. And I've done both. So anyway. 9th step, make direct amends. Now, this is where the rubber hits the road. And people want to put this off, of course, including myself, to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I had to write out, even if they were going to be face-to-face, I had to write out all my amends and share them with my sponsor before I made them. The only one I didn't do that with it is the one that ended up booting me out of my career for a while. So he was right. And every amends I had to change dramatically because I was either explaining, you know, why I had done this harm, or excusing, well, you'll want to know that I'm in 12-step recovery now. I can't tell you what, but that's what I'm in. You know, blah, 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 blah. And, or throwing it back on them. You know, I was really so taken aback by that day when you assaulted me that I ended up assaulting you and I was wrong. You know, you made me take all that kind of stuff out. And so it just became a clear statement of, I was wrong, blah, blah, blah. I ask your forgiveness. And that formula has turned out to be the, in 10th step it's the same formula, turned out to be the magic one for me, because it's so clear. And it's, first of all, it's really clear to say I was wrong, about this. There's something about that word wrong, and the general advice I've received is to ban the word apologize, and that's turned out to be a pretty good rule. Not because it's a bad word, but just because it's been abused so terribly. And then I ask your forgiveness. That's the humbling part. I have to ask forgiveness from these people, whatever. And it really is humbling. And with my son, when I got sober, this is 10th step now, I kept raging at him. Went on for a while. And I would go make an amends. I was wrong. I ask your forgiveness. And finally, it was so humiliating to say that second part over and over again that I stopped raging. I decided it wasn't worth making amends anymore. I was finished with that. So the only thing to do is don't create a situation. And we had a conversation about it a few months later. And he said, I'm really glad you don't get mad at me like that anymore. It's like, oh, what a surprise. Step 11 for me is the daily, it's the most important step for me, just because it's the one I literally have to work on a daily basis. I could say so much on step 11 that I'm going to deal with it by just saying that, letting it go. I hope you're seeing it and hearing it in some extent here today. And step 12, I remember the first time I called Hardy, and I don't even remember what I said, but I said something about, I'm doing it differently, Hardy. This is really amazing. And he said, you're having a spiritual awakening. And I remember that feeling of, wow. Because even with all the work, I still had part of me that didn't think it worked for me, And to have that confirmation that the result of these steps is not only a spiritual awakening, it's a spiritual awakening that I can have. And sometimes it's a spiritual awakening like shutting up, which I'm going to do in about 30 seconds. Sometimes it was a spiritual awakening, like not getting into dangerous situations. I tell people the single most powerful recovery tool we have is this thing attached to our ankle. And the most likely problem that people have is when they don't use it. If I use my feet, I'm most likely going to have a good day. Because if I'm in a dangerous situation, I'll leave. But that's the kind of thing that spiritual awakenings, they're not always big deals in terms of some mystical sense, but they're always big deals in my sense of, oh, this really can work for me. And if it can work for me, it can work for anybody. And then, of course, we carry this message and practice the principles in all our affairs. But we said we'd take a break. Let's do it. Let's come back together. What I want to do when we come back is I'm going to start right up with the very first page of the AA Big Book, the blank page. So that's where we'll begin. Step 10, she says, it says when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. It doesn't say if we were wrong or just in case I made a mistake this one time or, we will be wrong. And that's been very helpful to me when I first heard her say it. That one of the nice things about step 10 is there's 100% likelihood I will be wrong about this, that, or the other thing. And that's not the issue. And I often think it is, it's not. The issue is what do I do? And promptly, of course, is a variable concept. Promptly can range from seconds to years, decades, or never. One of the things that definitely happens over time if people stay around the program is promptly get shorter and shorter. Early on, Harvey said to me that, David, this is a program of comfort. And he didn't mean being lazy or, having things go easily all the time. He meant that I will learn to live inside the boundaries, the behaviors, the thoughts, whatever, where I can be comfortable. And equally importantly, if I am uncomfortable, I need to do something about it. And so 10th step is the way in which I'm allowed to stay comfortable. If I'm wrong, I start obsessing usually. I'll get tense. I'll want to. I can almost always tell if I need to work step 10 if I want to blurt something out, because that's often my way of dealing with tension. And I don't always catch myself, but I do most of the time. And and just, you know, take a break. We use that acronym, H-A-L-T, HALT, you know, and hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Most people know it and can say it and all that. What most people, including myself, forget is that what it means is stop. You know, don't go any further. And go to bed, you know, eat dinner, call somebody, whatever is needed, you know, write a fourth step, whatever it is, but whatever it is, whatever you're doing, stop. And of course, my ego says, you can't stop, this is important, you've made a commitment, you said blah, 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 they want this from you, blah, blah, blah. Stop. So, that's step 10. Does that help? My favorite paragraph in the entire 12 and 12 is in step 10. And since it was introduced, I'll read it as our opening reading. Could we close the door? This is probably done more to recenter me when I'm getting weird, and I have ample opportunities to remember it. And so I finally just memorized it because I knew I wouldn't always have the book with me. It's on page 92. Finally, we begin to see that all people, including ourselves, are to some extent emotionally ill, as well as frequently wrong. And then we approach true tolerance and see what real love for our fellows actually means. It will become more and more evident as we go forward that it is pointless to become angry or to get hurt by people who, like us, are suffering from the pains of growing up. If there's any one paragraph that has allowed me to stay in my marriage and to not take the normal stuff of life and make it much, much worse, it's that one. When my wife or anybody important to me is upset with me about something or, you know, whatever, when I can just remember it's pointless to get angry or be hurt by people who, like ourselves, like us, are suffering from the pains of growing up. And, you know, growing up, growing pains are no laughing matter for anybody. And we have that in common. So that's step 10, too. So on the inside cover of the AA Big Book, there's a blank page. And my sponsor taught this to Jess. Jess taught it to me. And for what it's worth, if you care to keep track of this, I'll pass it on to you. And it's been a great gift for any number of reasons that I'll talk about as we go through. And on that blank page, he had me write it in pencil. But the truth is, I annotate my book anyway, so ink wouldn't make any difference to me. And that was, we begin with a blank and open mind, just like this page. We begin with a blank and open mind. And then he had me drew a little arrow to the right and the number 86, which meant turn to page 86. So that's, after you've written that, if you care to do it, you turn to page 86. And then two-thirds of the way down the page, there's a paragraph that begins on awakening. And he had me write in C for cover, and then a little arrow pointing to the word on. And I actually put a little half bracket because that's the system I use, which means begin there. And here's what he had in mind. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Then he had me do a little end mark. I use a half bracket again. And then a little arrow to the right again, and the number 25. So go to page 25. At 25, he had me mark the beginning, at there is a solution, and I wrote in the 87, so I knew where I was coming from. And when somebody who has the book, please read that paragraph, there is a solution. Anybody?
There is a solution. Almost none of us like this self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we have not even dreamed.
And that's where the end mark came after dream, and then the arrow, and a 63. So the next page would be 63. I'm going to go back through this, but I thought we'd do fairly quickly, but I thought we'd do the pieces first. And on page 63, he basically had me bracket the third step prayer. So beginning with God, I offer myself, and ending with I will always. So that's where the brackets go. And then, we just did it at the beginning, so we won't do it again. And then after the thy will always, the arrow said to page 76. So I have to say 76. And on 76, the brackets were around the seventh step prayer there. And would somebody please read it through the Amen? Anybody?
My Creator, I'm now willing for you to have. My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of the good and bad. Pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
And as one person in AA pointed out to me, this is the first prayer in the big book that has an amen after. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that means anything. And then the arrow after the amen, or I put it in the left margin, was to page 77, just the next page. This one is a real sleeper. It's been there all along, and yet when my sponsor made me look at it separately, it really hit me. And it's just the third physical line of the page, beginning with our real purpose. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And then end in the bracket. And that really, for some reason, that really grabbed me. It was something about taking it out of the context and it's kind of like that primary purpose for the group. In Tradition 5, this was like primary purpose for in this case. And then after the people about us, the arrow at page 85. And there's three more. This is the first one of the three. And it begins with, it is easy. Would someone read that paragraph, please?
It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe.
Of course, we would substitute lust in our heads anyway. Yeah.
We are not cured of sexaholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve the Thy will, not mine, be done? These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will.
And that's where the end bracket would go, proper use of the will, and then the arrow is to page 89. And page 89, it's just the first two paragraphs, so beginning with practical experience and ending with our lives. And would someone read those two paragraphs anyway?
Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other sexaholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other sexaholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives.
And that's the end of the section there, and the arrow would go to page 69. And on page 69, it begins about a little over halfway down the page, the paragraph begins in this way. You know, it's just two sentences. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We suggested each relation to this test, was it selfish or not? And then that's the end of this little, is it nine? I think nine things or ten. When he passed this on to me, and I did it every day for a while, and now I just do it now and again, it really, there are many parts of the big book I like, and many of them are actually on this little trail. Partly, it gets me into all the pieces, or not all, many pieces of the book. But partly, it really picks up some pieces that have just been so important to me. Lots of people have asked me, and I've certainly had times when I was sort of very actively wondering this myself, what is healthy sexuality? What is a kind of sexual relationship that's okay with, you know, the only other program that's kind of like SA in this respect is OA, and because people keep eating food and couples keep, you know, engaging in sexual activity, not always, but frequently. And is it what makes healthy eating? What makes healthy sex? It's a perfectly good question. The answer is in these two paragraphs, and especially in those two sentences. You know, we review our own conduct over the years past, where we've been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate. Okay, this is in fact step four, of course, but it's also just working the steps and going back over our lives. Who would we hurt? 8 and 9. Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? That's sort of our contribution. Where did we get it? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We get this down on paper and looked at it. And then, and we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test, was it selfish or not? And my sponsor asked me, and I did this was quite a while ago now, and then I passed it on to others in the meantime. So write up a sane and sound ideal for your future sex life. What's it going to look like? It's a very interesting exercise to do, and then to share it. And to remember, as it says, that our sex powers are God-given, and therefore good, neither to be used lightly nor selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Page 89, that part that we came from to get to here, is still, other than the feet, still the most practical, I mean, most powerful practical tool for sobriety, and that is if I'm struggling with wanting to lust or with a lust hit or, you know, fantasy or whatever it is, if I work with another sexaholic, which almost always means simply calling somebody or going to a meeting, it'll go away. And not only that, if I do it over and over again, my whole life will take on new meaning. This is not just for other people, it's for me. And I can't tell you, it probably happens on the order of once a day. I don't want to exaggerate, but I think it's pretty close to true. Where someone who's just got, they've been on the internet, you know, they called some woman that they had a phone number or something like that. And they said, they'll say, and I thought of calling you, and I didn't do it. And I say, because it would have stopped it, right? And they always say, yeah. I mean, we know that in our gut, that if we actually get on our knees, if we actually make the phone call, it's going to stop it, and we don't want to stop it. Which is why we have to get back further from the edge, because when we're at that point, it's hopeless. But this is the thing that that really does it in practical terms. Page 85 is that wonderful part about the spiritual program of action resting on our laurels, the daily reprieve. And one of the things I like about, in addition to the focus on how can I best serve thee, thy will not mine be done, is the reminder that what we are offered and what is there for me to accept is a spiritual solution to an extremely difficult problem that causes problems for me and for other people, my sexual addiction. And this is a spiritual solution that works if I keep it maintained, if I keep using it. And there's all sorts of other distractions that come along that are physical solutions. You know, a lot of people have filters on their internet. Fine. I haven't ever found one that works, but go ahead if you like it. People give other people their money, their wallet, their charge cards, their ATM cards, whatever. Fine. I've never yet seen anybody who couldn't get around it, but that's fine if you want to do it. Because the real solution is going to be a spiritual solution. It's going to be our relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And people are welcome to try out their emotional and physical solutions. If they work, more power to them. The only time I've ever seen it work is if someone probably wasn't really one of us in the first place, wasn't an addict. And I've met people like that, quite a few actually, who their lives are out of control. They come to SA for a while, they stop acting up, they go away and they're fine. But they weren't addicts. Because that's not on our list of choices, to be fine. And for people who, you know, really are addicts and belong here, we'll try everything. We think it's the easier, softer way. But this is what's going to do it. That's what does it for me. On page 77, as I said, that sentence just jumped out at me when he pulled it out like this. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And I forget this frequently. People have expectations of me, and yet I have to recenter on that. Is it my being service to my higher power, to God as I understand, and my being service to the people about me? I've had all sorts of people say, well, I've done a lot of that and it doesn't work for me, or I get crazy, or my codependency gets kicked off. I really think that in every case where I've had any extended experience with the person, that there was still this element, I have to do this to make so-and-so happy, my husband, my wife, my employer, my co-workers, whatever. It's still, as it says in page 98, as long as we place dependence on other people ahead of dependence on God, we simply are not going to stop drinking. And it'd be nice if that were the case, but it's not. It's just kidding. The seven-step prayer is that wonderful kind of piece of grace that says God wants all of me, good and bad, and has a use for all of it. And then there's that disgusting little piece that says, take away my difficulties that stand in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And it took me about 7 years, 8 years before I realized that meant he was going to lead in the defects that were useful to others. Like, I'm frequently late to meetings, and that's a really wonderful character defect for others to see. I don't want to do it the way he does it. He really doesn't, screws up the meetings and everything, so on. So that's one of the things I wanted to say about the book. The solution on page 25 is really critical to me. That page 98 stuff that I mentioned is really critical to me. Job or no job, wife or no job, wife, we simply do not stop drinking or lusting as long as we place dependence on another person ahead of dependence on God. Burn this idea into the consciousness of every man or woman. We can get sober, we can get well, as long as we place dependence on God. Clean house and trust God. These things are in there because it's not only the experience of alcoholics, but also because they work. And it's the tools that we need, in my experience, I need to have anyway, to work. There are lots of other portions of the big book. I just want to say a bit about literature. This is our newest piece, Practical Tools for Recovery. It's a collection of articles from the SA over a 10-year period. In reality, most of them are from about 2000, 1999 or so on. And it has quite an extended section on the steps. Some of you may have been here when Harvey was here a couple of years ago and talked about what is sex with self. And That is in here. It's actually right in the first four pages. Then it has a bunch of practical tools, a daily contract for sobriety, which is real helpful to people, gratitude lists, daily renewals, and various other sort of prayers, things like that, that are really helpful. I've had a lot of people tell me that they've started using it in their meetings and their groups, and it's been helpful to them, and it's been helpful to me. I don't read my way through this one yet, partly probably suppose because of my history with it, but I find myself referring to it constantly, so I guess it's serving some role in my life. The white book and the recovery continues. I find a lot of people don't use recovery continues. It's fine, but it sure makes life harder. I think Roy and the people who edited it with him really did a fine job, and it's also the quickest one, so there's kind of a satisfaction to get through each story quickly. But as I said today, the section I just happened to be on, what's it on? Self-awareness and sexual dreams. But he talks about when we get sober, we just become aware of how much we were lusting and how much it was running my life. And it's exactly what I needed to be able to talk today. The white book does the same thing. It's always a right place for me. Today it was on the beginning of step 6 and 7 and on the end of the 5th step. I always really trust that wherever I open the book to is going to be the right place for me that day, and that's certainly been my experience. I read as Bill sees it. Probably it's the most frequent one I read on a daily basis, partly because it's quick. It's also very useful. 12 and 12 I mentioned. I was brought up in the tradition of using the AA literature heavily because that's the core of our program, and using the SA literature consistently because that's the translation into our disease. So I do that. That's worked well for me. And then I happen to use one of the meditation books. This particular one, I think, is out of print. But it's outside literature, and I wouldn't ever use it in the meeting or read it in the meeting. But I found for me it's been a helpful anchor. I suppose this one happens to be entitled In God's Care. And I suppose because I came in with my issues about God, that it's been helpful to me to give me a context for God that's broad in the way I need it. And I think these meditation books can often be useful for that. Not that they're any substitute for a program reading. A lot of people use them that way, and I think it's a mistake. But because it allows me to keep a breadth of view and a connection to a broader 12-step program, recovery, community view, whatever, than I would have otherwise. So, I do read the essay. I subscribe to the Grapevine. I would have brought one and waved it at you, but by mistake, I give away my old issues, and by mistake, I gave away my May issue, which I hadn't even read yet. But I tell people the place I use the Grapevine, which is the AA magazine, anytime I'm in a large crowd, I will have a Grapevine in my front pocket, or occasionally if I have a briefcase, I'll have it in my briefcase. Because if I get scared, I need to do something quick. Maybe I can make a phone call, but I can always pull out a Grapevine. Nobody knows what I'm doing, and it's always going to recenter me. Not only on the program and on what I'm doing, but also on God. That's where the source of serenity has to come from anyway. I usually have them almost blocked. But anytime I'm stuck waiting for someone, I can pull out a Grapevine and read it. It truly is a meeting in print. It's what the essay aspires to be. We're getting there. But it's available now. My translator for alcohol and alcoholism and lust and sexualism has become pretty automatic, so I don't have to worry about it. I think that's enough of me just chalking. Maybe how long can we have just conversation and then we'll quit? Or do we need to quit this minute? While we're waiting, anything? Anybody want to share?
Yeah. What do you keep in your pocket?
A Grapevine, the AA publication. The Grapevine. It's the AA magazine.
Oh, okay.
Very useful. And I keep my coin. I almost invariably lose it. I haven't lost this one yet. I'm not quite sure why. But then I just go get another one. Go down to the central office, buy another one.
So I always have that. And every once in a while, I went through security about six months ago. I don't know where I was going. And I had the coin out. And this TSA lady leaned over and said, I've got 4 years. Good for you. But most people have no idea what it is. And I carry, on my keychain, I have the SA Desire chip, the 24-hour chip. And I can honestly say in 16 years, in 3 months, I've been asked about it maybe once. And yet I have grabbed it thousands of times. Every time I operate my car, every time I reach for my house key, every time I stick my hand down there, it's there. And so I found it to be no threat. And I found it to be, and I just say, oh, it's a social group I belong to, which I really shouldn't say because it's not a social group, but it's something that I think people can translate. So but I don't answer their question. I just say it's me. Yeah.
Dave, you had referenced before you went through the nine things, a reading. You said on page 92, we're on the 10th step.
That's in 12 and 12.
Oh, in 12.
And it is, and that's my favorite paragraph. That and that line at the end of step 7. Mm-hmm. If anybody hasn't done it, by the way, or maybe a lot of you haven't, I really recommend memorizing the St. Francis Prayer, which is in step 11 in 12 and 12, because it's so soothing. It has gotten me through literally people screaming at me about something. And I'll just be standing there or sitting doing the St. Francis Prayer feeling much better than they are. And but the other thing is it's nice and long, you know. And if you're in trouble, just say, God help me, God help me. Jess said, the good thing about God help me is you can get a lot of them in a short space. But sometimes it's just lengthy. Lord's Prayer is fine, but the St. Francis Prayer is wonderful because it's not only long, it's very soothing. You can't get to the end of it without feeling better. Other people, questions? Do we need to stop?
I built some flex in, so okay. We can actually go till 3 if there's...
You know what I'd like to do is sit. I don't mind talking, but answering or responding. And if anybody wants to share anything, who's got the most recent sobriety in the room? Who's in the last month? Anybody? Got a bunch of old timers. Last 2 months? You. What's it been like for you the last 2 months? How's it going?
Can't sit so hard.
I can't.
It started out very difficult. The first 30 days were very, very difficult. And that 30-day span period really was... seemed like an eternity. The last 30 days haven't been quite as bad, but you know, I've kind of had waxing and waning moments throughout the last 30 days as well. My desire to act out has diminished a fair amount, but my desire to lust is the same high it's always been at.
And what tools are working the best for you? What tools do you wish you had?
I can't say that any particular tool more than anything else works the best for me, other than the fact that if I do something every day, do the things that I need to do on a daily basis, not only with program material, but with my life as well, exercising, right, those things, that makes things a lot more tolerable. Some of the things, from my own religious perspective, I try to get to church just for silent prayer a couple times a week, and that helps a lot to stay connected. Mm-hmm. In terms of what doesn't work, I don't know. I mean, like I said, there's not one thing that really works or doesn't work.
It sounds like the lust images, though, were pretty difficult at times.
Yes, yes. And I've been... going through that deal recently with a lot of erotic dreams at night over the past couple of weeks, which I never had before, mm-hmm. or infrequently.
And as I said, that's a real positive sign. So, one thing that's helped me, I shared it before the meeting, but there were only two or three people here. I stumbled a number of years ago now into a magic phrase that might be helpful when you're in the middle of the night and all that. And I call it my magic phrase because of the effect it has. And that is, I say frequently over and over again,
God, I surrender to you my right to have erections and to be sexually responsive at all. And I can put emphasis in various places on that, although usually the at all gets most of it. And it's just this incredible thing. It just reduces stuff. It just takes it out of me. And it's when I first bumbled into it, I was really amazed, but I found. And if I'm going to, the two things I do in the middle of the night, one is that and the other is the first step prayer. If I'm going to fill my head with lust stuff, I might as well fill it, or divine dreams or whatever, I might as well fill it with that. And I got to a point a number of years ago now where I would start doing the third step prayer in the dream or in the middle of the night and not know what I was, I didn't even know why I was doing it. And that still is true to this day. I'll frequently wake up at 2 or 3 or 4 a.m. and be doing the third step prayer. And I just figure, I don't have to know. I don't care. I don't care why I'm doing it. I just want to be doing it. And anyway, it's been really helpful.
Did you have your hand up?
And you have a sponsor?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And, you know, you're the reason that the rest of us keep coming back. So it's nice to have you here. Other people? Who else has fairly recent sobriety? 2 months, 3 months, 4 months? Where are you? Yeah. How many months?
4 months. It was today. It's day 14, 3 days.
Yeah. And what tools have worked best for you?
Tools that have worked best for me is a day is something, just daily surrender, daily prayer. Even when I didn't believe it. And I think the thing that the confusion that I felt and all the selfishness that I felt but was still in control of my life was just letting that go. That was probably the thing I'm trying to do and working on. Finally decided to start actually working the steps.
Mm-hmm.
That was hard to start. So, that daily prayer is the best. And the thing that I think I find most helpful for me is to remember God's will, not mine, be done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, but to truly believe that, that's the hard part. But I still say it all the time.
Yeah.
I found myself once when I was really praying hard, and I was actually reading, I think it was the third step prayer, and I actually reversed it and said, my will, not yours, be done. I was like so embarrassed. It was such a slip, but that's exactly what I was doing in my life. So
it wasn't a slip. It was just the truth.
God was just maybe showing me that. But I do know that when I feel the halt, you know, that when I feel those feelings of especially loneliness and fear, of how things are going in my life, that's when the lust really starts to come back, and the visions, and I really think the most helpful tool for me is just that, God, I surrender this. I mean, the minute I feel it coming on, I just say, God, I surrender this.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a while when I was being especially woeful, where I would say, God, I surrender this, and it wouldn't go away. God, I surrender this, but it wouldn't go away. And I'm like, why isn't it going away? And then I just kind of realized that it wasn't really surrendering it. I was really struggling with it, trying to do it with my will. And that was helpful to just, because then I just, that was enlightening for me, because then I just said, no, God, I surrender this to you. And it just, it was this one vision I was having. And it was just so hard to live in a visual world that stimulates this disease. And it just, that was very helpful for me. So
I was reading a developmental brain textbook for a class, and it said the cells that are in the, I think it's nucleus accumbens, but it's some part of our brain anyway, that are the cells that give us sexual arousal. When the fetus is developing, the cells divide and part of them migrate a little bit and become the end of the optic nerve. And I'll tell you, when I read that, I get it. Even telling you now, I got goosebumps. I thought, of course, you know, this whole disease is a disease of my eyeballs, my optic.
optic nerve, the end of my optic nerve, and it's the same cells. And I don't know whether how much literal physiological truth there is to that, but the image alone is sufficient. You know, of course it's through my eyes. You know, and then I add all the other good, you know, goodas. But Mother Nature took care of that arousal thing a long time ago. The problem is some of us develop this craving, you know, and we don't know how long we're going to do it, and what, you know, to what extent, and then we have to do something different. That's, you keep doing it. It's obviously working.
It's getting better.
Yeah. Anybody else want to share or ask? Or
I want to ask a question, David and Rich. You and I have both been around for a lot of years and seen a lot of people come and go. And I wanted to say this as a matter of challenging what you said a moment ago, but just maybe to for us to expand on it for a moment. It's been my experience that a lot of people come to our meetings and they get well. Mm-hmm. And rather than saying that therefore means they're not sexaholics, it's not the way that I like to use the name sexaholic or the name sexual addict. And that's one way of doing it. In other words, maybe this is just a matter of definition of terms, but it's been very encouraging to me. One of the things that I enjoy doing is running into those folks who were in the program back in the 80s and who came to the meetings for a year or two or three, and especially when they did the work along with their spouses and got active in the Recovering Couples Anonymous meetings and found the balance that they didn't have in their marriages when they began recovery. And I find it very encouraging. And the parallel that I find for it, David, is that I know a lot of alcoholics who don't go to meetings anymore. And rather than choosing to say, well, that must mean they're not alcoholics, I choose to say, yes, they are alcoholics. However, their sobriety has really worked for them. And they really don't... They may drop by once a year to pick up their annual chip, but it really worked. They really became whole. Now, so I've said enough. Your comments on that, I really appreciate.
Well, you may well be right. You know, I think we are still such a baby program that I think, you know, we're still learning about people who are in relationships and are maybe being sexual and they're not sober by our definition. And they get married and they go on to have, maybe they have their ups and downs, of course, but they go on to have fine marriages or okay marriages. And I think it's an area we don't know a lot. And that happens to be affecting me right now and someone who's real important to me in my life. And I think it's the same way with people who come and get well. You know, or get a lot better and go off and they seem to do fine. Or, now some of those people are working a spiritual program in another context, and that makes total sense to me. But some people really are just doing their stuff and living life and they're not doing anything particularly spiritual. And I guess my basic sense about that is that, that they're not the kind of sexaholic I am, I don't think, or that I see most often at meetings over a long period of time. But I would agree with you, and I stand corrected. That if they identify as sexaholics and have found a way of... And they will probably be sober, by our definition, and it's working, then it's not right for me or anybody to say they're not sexaholics or that it didn't work for them or anything like that. So I think you're right. Certainly, people do come and they're like, you know, more people are alcohol abusers than are alcohol dependent in the DSM sense. You know, that they use alcohol in a way that their lives are really have terrible consequences, but the truth is they can stop. And when they have sufficient consequences, they do stop. And I guess that was the background for my remark. But you're absolutely correct about what you say about people who go to AA probably really are alcoholics and seem to get better. And I think it's just an area where we don't know a lot yet. We haven't written about it. We haven't talked to enough people or had enough, you know, speakers or whatever to
really share. So I'm glad you shared that. I don't argue. I do think for people who are really having ongoing, I am needing to surrender lust images and lust desires and fantasies on a daily basis, and I do it at meetings, and I have had many people say, after all these years, you're still struggling with it? And I say, yep, that's the way it works and for me. And I think it is the way it works for a lot of people dealing with this disease, but not all, which is what you're saying, and I agree with that. I think for people who have this kind of, as Dr. Bob did, for a long time the cravings didn't go away, and I think that this needs to be a real, the place where they can be. So I don't think they're contradictory, though. They're exclusive. Other people? Anybody? Well, why don't we wind up maybe with, well, let's do a prayer of some sort. Somebody can choose one.
Before we do that, David, I want to present you with just a little token of our thanks. I get the feeling that you're the kind of guy that needs a book like this. This one's titled The Book for People Who Do Too Much. Probably after 16-plus years.
My wife will enjoy it immensely.
Yeah.
She says this about me on a daily basis.
Oh, maybe you do need that book.
I do need this
book. On the airplane. And this is a wonderful little book called The Zen of Zelda.
This looks exactly like my sponsor. Any of you wonder? It's such a, what a wonderful gift, I'll tell you.
That we'd like you to have those, and it's going to give you a heartfelt thanks.
Wisdom from the Doggy Lama.
Thanks for being here.